This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we'll hear about thousands of veterans, active duty service members, and those who have served in the U.S. military gearing up for a national demonstration in D.C. on March 20th.
Obama said he'd get troops out of Iraq, and he hasn't done it. He's put them in Afghanistan. He's putting in more. Go on this march. Support the soldiers. Be there. Get them out of both countries.
The John Brown Farm State Historic Site in North Elba, New York. State lawmakers want to close it.
The old Civil War song, John Brown's body lies a molder than his grave, but his truth goes marching on, is in danger because they want to shut down the farm where John Brown is buried.
Stay with us.
Economics professor Rick Wolf, you're on the board of directors of the Left Forum. It's going to be a really wonderful three-day event this year from March 19th through 21st here in New York City. I think that this year is really extraordinary given the political situation. What's the title and the theme of the forum and what's going to be happening there?
The title we chose for this one, which we hoped and now know will be the biggest we've ever had, we're expecting 3,000 people easily to gather. We have 200 panels on every conceivable topic. We're particularly excited at this historic time in America, historic both because we have a severe capitalist crisis, the second in 75 years that's really laid our economy low, and we have an African-American president that's certainly a new thing for this country. There's something particularly appropriate in the fact that the left has returned and wants to have a place in the discussion of this nation, and that people as diverse as Jesse Jackson and Noam Chomsky are gathering together to bring together a wide-ranging debate on what needs to be done, what changes have to occur in this country, and how the left can understand and strategize and work to make those kinds of changes. We are hosted at Pace University. We believe that the university has a commitment to opening the kind of debate that we're engaged in. They've been very supportive. We are very appreciative. The theme of this year's Left Forum is The Center Cannot Hold.
Isn't that a line from a poem by Auden?
Yes, I think so. And it's also, I think, appears in Shakespearean plays. It's really a line that has come to represent when the conventional, tired, old politics of the what used to be called the vital center, when it turns out it's not so vital, it's kind of falling apart, and people are asking the traditional old political questions of what is to be done and which way to go. And this represents a gathering of people who think that where we ought to go is move to the left, and these are the ways to do it, and these are the issues to foreground. And I think it will be an exciting way for people to see what kind of thinking is going on in the left, what initiatives are being taken, to find and meet people who are involved in those struggles and those processes. And so we're very excited about being able to produce this in the heart of New York City, across from City Hall. It's a special time, a special occasion, and we really urge people to come and participate and think out loud with others who share some basic assumptions.
Now, a lot of the panels and the opening and the closing with Jackson and Chomsky are going to be up on the net. We'll link to it at our website, lawanddisorder.org, and you can also get it at the Left Forum website, which is leftforum.org.
Yes, we're very proud that we've been criticized in the past, and the criticisms were well taken, that we have not made more of what we do available afterwards. So we're doing more recording audio and video of panels and plenaries than ever before, and they will be on the website www.leftforum.org for people who can't make it or who want to go back and revisit some of the panels they might have missed. This will be a way for us to keep alive and keep spreading what goes on at this historic Left Forum.
I think that's wonderful that you've gotten to the high-tech capacity and also raised the funds to do it so that this will get preserved. I know you're going to do one panel on Marxism and religion. I'm going to do another one on how to make a revolution in the United States with Harmony Goldberg and Paul LeBlanc and Kazembe Balogun. Tell us about Marxism and religion. Why do you think that's important now?
Well, one of the reasons we set up that particular panel this year was we had such success with a similar panel at last year's Left Forum. We got so many requests to continue that discussion. to ask and explore the question of how that part of the religious community in the United States that does not want to be thought of as right-wing, as conservative, as super patriotic, and all of that kind of thing, there are a lot of people in the religious communities, in all the religions, who have a left-of-center or leftist perspective, who believe in social justice, believe in social change. And so this panel actually comes out of the Union Theological Seminary in Upper Manhattan, a religious divinity school, where there are many people of this persuasion who want to support the idea that there ought to be a discussion of how Marxism and religion and social justice concerns and religion should talk to each other, should compare notes, should see what they can work on together. And it was very exciting last year. A lot of audience participation, very large audience. So that's, in a sense, this year's is a continuation of what was a successful panel at last year's Left Forum.
And Rick, there are going to be people from Europe, I know, French party, the new anti-capitalist party, the Link party in Germany. It would be a wonderful development if we could do something like that here in the United States. And to have that kind of resource, to have these people come over from Europe to talk with is real kudos for you for organizing that.
Yeah, I might mention that we have at this point a minimum of 5 complete panels that will be set up by our friends in Europe. Some come from a journal over there called Transform that links left-of-center political parties all across Europe. They're going to be raising the questions that are interesting to people about new left developments that are very strong in some countries in Europe, what the crisis in Greece that we're reading about might mean, how the labor movement is changing and fighting against the efforts to deal with the global capitalist crisis on the backs of people by cutting their wages, by cutting social services. It's something Americans who face the same problem may learn some very useful things in terms of what the Europeans are doing in the struggles they're having. So yes, we're very proud that this is an international kind of event. We do not want to limit our purview just to the United States. We cover not just Europe, but Asia, Africa, a lot of panels from Latin America and about developments in Latin America. So those who have an interest in broader than the United States issues, they'll have more panels than they'll be able to attend.
When you're not busy doing one of your own panels, which ones do you think you're going to want to try to attend?
Well, I do a lot of work teaching economic theory, and while they're not as numerous as last year, which is interesting, we still have many panels that will be dealing with the economic crisis, the housing crisis, the debt crisis, these economic transformations that are shaking our society to its foundation. So my guess is you'll find me looking to find opportunities to attend those and to see what people are thinking. We're very proud. We have everything from people active in their trade union to economic specialists who work in the hedge fund industry and everything in between who share a common critical perspective, even if they come at it from different points of view. And I think those will be very exciting for people who are concerned about the economy, which is pretty much all of us.
I think that to title the Left Forum 2010, The Center Cannot Hold, was really a flashing insight, because that's exactly, I think, what's going on. I think there's a lot of disappointment out there with Obama, that they believed what he said and then saw that he really channeled Bush in so many basic ways. And I think there's a thinking going on now about, well, what should we do? We can't rely on either the Republican or the Democratic Party. Where do we go from here? And I imagine there's going to be a lot of discussion about that.
Yes, we hope that there will be. That's our intent. We hope that in different ways, both Reverend Jackson and Noam Chomsky will address this kind of question. We welcome that they will look at it differently, because we know there are many perspectives, and the job of those of us left of center who gather here is to explore all of them in an open way without hectoring one another, to hear what we actually have to say and debate what divides us as well as what unites us as part of a growth process for the left in the United States.
I'm so encouraged that this is happening, because I think that this is the first step towards what eventually has to be a regroupment in an organized way of the left, because the center cannot hold. And when it doesn't, the vast population out there is going to go one way or the other. And you can see the right wing organizing now, and you see the left wing beginning to get together. This year's Left Forum is one of those very crucial steps. You, Rick Wolf, and the rest of the people on the board of the Left Forum are to be congratulated for all your hard work. It's a working board. You've put this together. You're to be congratulated for putting on this year's Left Forum.
I wish I had the time to thank all the different people in the institutions. We get a lot of support. It's true we're a working board. It's true we have the endless problems of fundraising that you can all imagine. But the bottom line is it couldn't possibly happen unless there were the desire, the will. Just think of it. 200-plus panels, an average of 4 people per panel. Do the math. All these people who want to come, want to participate, want to engage, that's what makes it possible. There is, as Michael correctly says, there's a groundswell. I think the people coming do all agree in one way or another that a left that is strong and vocal and has something to say to the American people is what we have to do, and we have to now struggle how to do it.
So you can get the programs. If you're not going to be able to make it, or you're hearing this program after the Left Forum has been put on, you can reach us at lawanddisorder.org. We're going to link to leftforum.org. There'll be programs up on the net from the Left Forum. We welcome your listening and your participation. And Rick Wolf, thanks so much for being on Law and Disorder.
Thank you for an opportunity to help spread the word.
On Saturday, March 20th, there will be a massive national march and rally in Washington, D.C., organized against the Iraq and Afghanistan wars and for social and economic justice at home. The demonstrations will pull together veterans, active duty service members, and those who have served in the U.S. military. Other mass rallies will be held on the same day in San Francisco and Los Angeles. And the day before, on Friday, March 19th, there will be a day of action and outreach. Today, Michael Preisner joins us to give us more information and details on this mass demonstration. Michael is the lead coordinator of March Forward and a member of Iraq Veterans Against the War. He recently delivered a powerful speech at Winter Soldier as an IVAW member. In Michael's speech, quote, "Our real enemies are not those living in a distant land whose names or policies we don't understand. The real enemy is a system that wages war when it's profitable. The CEOs who lay us off our jobs, when it's profitable. The insurance companies who deny us health care, when it's profitable. The banks who take away our homes, when it's profitable. Our enemies are not several hundred thousand miles away. They are right here in front of us." Michael Preisner, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thanks for having me.
We're just a few weeks away from a big action planned in D.C. on March 20th. An anti-war demo. I understand there will be actions on the same day in San Francisco and L.A., and you'll be participating?
That's correct.
You're with March Forward and also Iraq Veterans Against the War.
Yes, I'm a co-founder of March Forward, which is an organization of veterans and active duty service members as well, and I'm also, which is also an affiliate of the ANSWER Coalition, which stands for Act Now to Stop War and End Racism. So the bulk of my work is in March Forward and in the ANSWER Coalition, but also a proud member of Iraq Veterans Against the War as well.
Great. And tell us a bit about the demonstrations. How many people do you expect around the country? Will they be a lot of veterans and active duty service members? What are the demands?
Yeah, you know, it's difficult to say how many people are going to be there. You know, we've seen the anti-war movement really grow in large upsurges and, you know, having the largest anti-war demonstrations in history in some years. And then in other years, it's dwindled really depending on the political situation. But we know now that there's more and more people who are really becoming tired of the wars and what's going on. People who are getting tired of watching over $500 million a day being squandered on these senseless wars and occupations. While here at home, we're undergoing, you know, increasing economic hardship every single day. Really, every month, more and more jobs are lost. Things are getting more difficult for people trying to get access to health care and to housing and to jobs. So the material conditions for people really wanting to take a stand against the war, I think, is greater than it ever has been because of the sharpening of the contradictions there. But on March 20th, you're going to see people, thousands of people from all over the country. You know, people from all over the country are getting transportation to D.C. and to closer demonstrations in L.A. and San Francisco if they're on the West Coast. Because we're coming off of, you know, after a year of President Obama being elected, when many people thought that they were voting for an end to the war, that they were voting for a change to the colonial policies of the U.S. government. But it's become apparent that that's not the case. And this demonstration is to show that the people understand that change doesn't come through the elections. Change comes through a struggle and through a mass movement. And that's what March 20th is all about, to be there on the anniversary of the criminal invasion of Iraq that's killed over a million Iraqis, and to be there and stand up and say that we understand that it's going to take a fight, and we're going to fight until these wars end.
If people want to go on the demonstration and they want to look up on the website, how do they do it?
They can go to answercoalition.org for all the information, and that can link you up to whatever state you're in. You can find transportation centers and other people who are organizing for the demonstration. Also on that website, you can find ways to get involved, because we need volunteers. We're an all-volunteer organization. You can donate. There's many things you can do to be a part of making this demonstration successful.
Hundreds of organizations have endorsed this march and are leading their own efforts to recruit people to go to the respective cities.
Organizations and prominent individuals all over the country are endorsing the march. And, you know, I did want to say that there are going to be significant numbers of veterans and military families who are participating in these marches. And there's going to be who are leading the demonstrations, right? It's going to be people who saw firsthand the realities of these wars and families who lost loved ones at the forefront of these demonstrations as well. So really connecting the people who were most affected, and also drawing in all of these other the economic reasons why we should be opposed to these wars. People who have been foreclosed, people who have gone bankrupt because of health care bills, they're going to be featured in these demonstrations as well. And the demands of the demonstration is the U.S. out of Afghanistan and Iraq, an immediate end to those occupations, freedom for Palestine, reparations for Haiti, and money for jobs, education, housing, and health care, not for war.
Can you give me an explanation of what the United States is doing, continuing to be in Iraq, and why they went into Afghanistan?
These wars are for empire, quite literally. This is about the United States expanding its reach economically. These colonial-type occupations are really to seize the local economies, the natural resources, and the markets of these countries. And that's the bottom line. That's exactly the only reason why we are in these wars. Iraq, of course, was the more blatant criminal invasion just for profit. But Afghanistan as well, it's really hard to overstate the vast oil and natural gas wealth that is in Afghanistan and in surrounding countries. So it's these wars are for empire. It's for the expansion of U.S. business interests.
Michael, can you tell us a bit about your background? You were in Iraq?
I was. I went to Iraq in March 2003. I was a part of the initial invasion. I was 19 years old when I went. Very idealistic. You know, I really believed, I joined the Army out of patriotism because I believed that the military was a force for good in the world, and that we went places to help people and to free the oppressed and, to bring people freedom and democracy and those things. So when I was deployed to Iraq in March 2003, I was 17 when I joined the Army and 19 when I went to Iraq. Generally, I was supportive of the invasion when I went because I really believed that we were going to be helping people, that we were going to be doing a good thing. And then month after month of occupying the country, I began to realize that we were there for a very different purpose. And seeing firsthand the suffering of the Iraqi people, seeing how their lives were destroyed by the occupation, really began to make me question what we were really doing, the real role of the U.S. military. And then, you know, after a year of occupying Iraq, I came home with very different views about what I was supposed to be doing in Iraq and what I was a part of in the military serving the dictates of U.S. foreign policy.
Did others who you were with share sort of that eye-opening experience?
Many did. Many, not in such political terms, but knowing that something was wrong and knowing that what we were doing wasn't what we thought we were going to be doing. And there is this growing frustration within the military because, you know, people don't want to go and kill and be killed in these countries. People join the military because they need access to a job, because they need access to education, they need access to health care and to a home. That's why people join the military, the vast majority, because of the economic conditions here in the U.S. So they join the military thinking they're going to be doing something good, and then they're put in these situations that are really horrible, and it's very hard to deal with. So I would say that the potential for a mass movement within the military and the potential for soldiers to refuse to fight, to refuse to do what they're ordered to do is quite great because the conditions are worsening every single day for them.
The thing that kind of keeps soldiers together is they want to look out for each other, regardless of broader picture of, you know, why they're over there. You know, they're there and they protect each other. And I think that the Army plays upon that and goes after any dissidents to say that you're kind of undermining morale. You're going to put these people in danger. What kind of discussions did you used to have with your fellow soldiers over there about what was going on?
You know, it was mostly based on frustration about, you know, going out on missions that were pointless just so our officers could get awards by having their troops go into combat. Just really frustration over the ridiculousness of why we were there and really all of us seeing no point. And since then, you know, I've been organizing among active duty soldiers. I talk to soldiers every day who are in Iraq or in Afghanistan, who are coming home and getting discharged for PTSD. You know, I talk to a lot of people, and there is really this growing anti-war sentiment within the military because of the conditions that they're exposed to on a daily basis. So during the Vietnam War, for those who don't know, there was a massive GI movement within the military to the point where the military couldn't even conduct ground operations anymore because soldiers would refuse to go on missions. And that same potential exists today. And in my experience in talking to soldiers on a regular basis and organizing within the military, I'm seeing more and more that potential surfacing.
Not to take away from that point, because I think it's really important, but I wanted to ask, did you have much contact with Iraqi civilians? And did that factor into the growing disillusionment?
I did, and that's exactly what turned me around politically. You know, I initially didn't have a lot of contact with Iraqi civilians, and it was just being on the receiving end of rockets and mortars and things like that, right? And then having to try to understand your experiences from that aspect. But once I was in the cities and once I was in the towns, and interacting with the local people on a daily basis, it was the children that I saw that cried and screamed at us, that I dragged from their houses during raids. It was innocent people I saw who were shot, who were tortured in detention facilities. I mean, this is what turned me around. It was the Iraqi people seeing their faces and seeing what we were doing to them that made me realize that we were not welcome in that country, that we were not the liberators that we thought we were going to be. We were something very different. We were occupiers. We were colonizers.
For our listeners that just tuned in to Law and Disorder, we're speaking with Mike Prisner, who's in Iraq Veterans Against the War, and he's one of the key organizers of the upcoming March 20th demonstration in Washington, D.C. Mike, tell our listeners how they can join up and go on the demonstrations.
You can go to answercoalition.org. And all the information is on the website, how to volunteer, how to donate, how to find transportation to get to a demonstration, and other people around you who are organizing.
Have you had a chance to speak with soldiers that have been over in Afghanistan?
I have, yes.
What's your take on their experience over there?
Well, you know, the war in Afghanistan is a very interesting situation for soldiers. I mean, this previous 8 years of the war has really just been a debacle where soldiers essentially were just used as bait, right? They just get put at a little outpost and just wait to be attacked, and then they get attacked, and then they call in airstrikes and then kill the people who are attacking them. And it's just this kind of constant baiting where soldiers just put out there and just drawing insurgents out. It was kind of a situation where they're on a daily basis being put into very dangerous situations with no real express purpose, right? And it's even still, there's no clearly articulated reason why we have to fight and die endlessly in Afghanistan. So now when the conditions are worsening, right, you know, 2009 was by far the deadliest year of the war, doubling the previous year. And every year the resistance has grown and grown and grown. Now we know that the fighting is intensifying even more, and the generals have warned us that we should be braced for hundreds of U.S. casualties every single month. So those conditions are worsening. These two things working together for soldiers in Afghanistan. We have the daily horrors of war, the daily constant attacks, the constant witnessing of death and destruction and friends being killed and having to do horrible things. And then on the other hand, no reason why, no clear reason why, and just kind of cloaked in racism and chauvinism. And that's really all that is providing the justification for people to be doing these things. So that's why it's essential to be a part of the anti-war movement, to be in the streets, because soldiers see that. They know that that's happening. And that's how I became active in the anti-war movement. That's how many veterans became active in the anti-war movement, is seeing that there's this alternative, that there's this mass force of people who are against what's happening and who are trying to stop it. And that's also why it's essential to be organizing in the military and supporting veterans organizations. So us, people who have been there, can reach out to our brothers and sisters in the military and say, don't go, don't be a part of this. And that's what we're doing in March Forward, the organization that I founded with other veterans as well. MarchForward.org is the website. You can go and see our list of demands and what we're doing. But our goal and our organization, among other things, is to tell soldiers, those who are on their way to deploy to Iraq and Afghanistan, to refuse their orders, to not deploy. And if you're in Iraq or Afghanistan, refuse to take part in any more missions, because these are wars for profit, these are wars for empire, and young men and women have absolutely no reason to fight and die in these wars. We get a very different picture from Washington and from the media.
We're speaking with Mike Prisner, who's one of the organizers of the upcoming March 20th anti-war demonstrations in Washington and on the West Coast. Mike, I wanted to ask you, one of the movies that's up for an Academy Award that people are talking about is Hurt Locker. And I wonder whether you've seen that and what your reaction to that movie was.
You know, I haven't seen it, but I've read quite a bit about it. And, you know, I feel that, first off, you know, there's a great amount of inaccuracy with how the war is portrayed and the types of missions people go on and that kind of thing, which I think is very disingenuous when you're talking about a war that's actually going on right now, that people are fighting and dying in right now. And I think some historical accuracy would be in order. But I think that the main concern with that film is that it doesn't really humanize the Iraqi people. The Iraqi people have no voice in this film. The soldiers there, it kind of romanticizes and glamorizes combat. But I haven't seen it, so I can't really comment on it.
Well, but one thing I did want to ask of you is what kind of reading did you get to kind of broaden your understanding of the experiences that you put through?
Yeah, well, you know, I went into it very kind of right-wing politically when it came to foreign policy in the military. And, you know, having the ideas that I was really taught since I was a child growing up in the United States and going to public schools, you get a very one-sided view.
Where'd you grow up, in L.A.?
No, I grew up up north in New England, all around New Hampshire, Massachusetts, and then went to high school in Florida. So I bounced around a little bit.
What kind of view did you get?
Well, just that the United States is great, and that we every military venture has been this, you know, wonderful thing to try to help people and try to free the oppressed, and that is very appealing to young idealistic people who want to make a difference in the world. That think that by joining the military, you're going to build people's schools, and you're going to give them the right to vote, and all of these great things, which is what I thought we were doing going into Iraq. But, you know, it was really my own personal experiences that changed me politically. It wasn't anything that I was taught or anything I read. It was just having to live with what I did and having to live with what I was a part of and having to think about it all the time, every single day, and try to make sense of it. So that's where the understanding came from, was just from what I saw and comparing it to what I was told and realizing what the reality was.
Mike, it's been a pleasure to have you on. You'll be in L.A. on the 20th, right?
I will, yes.
Well, I'll be in D.C. thinking about you, and we hope that we get great crowds in both cities and in San Francisco as well. And we want to thank you so much for your candid conversation with us.
And before you hang up, give us that website once more, because we want to get as many people as possible out for the March 20th demonstrations.
Sure. Go to answercoalition.org, find out how to get involved, find out how to get to a demonstration. Really, everyone working together, this demonstration can have a big impact. It does impact the decisions of the U.S. government. And the more we fight and the more we struggle and the more we build the movement, the larger it's going to get until we eventually have the power to end the wars and to have that money used on things that people actually need in this country.
Perfectly said. Thanks, Mike.
Thank you, guys.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. Thank you.
This is Eli Smith from the Dustbusters, and you're listening to Law and Disorder. If you like this kind of old folk music, check out Down Home Radio at downhomeradioshow.com.
John Brown's farm in North Elba near Lake Placid in the Adirondacks is threatened with closure. It was from Brown's farm in 1859 that he organized the men that went down and captured the arsenal at Harper's Ferry in Virginia. Brown's plan was that black slaves would come pick up arms from the arsenal and fight to free themselves. It was Brown's hope that this would obviate what he obviously saw was the coming of the Civil War. Brown failed. His efforts have been a hidden history in America, only partly uncovered because only a few years ago the farm was preserved and made into a historic place, and now it's threatened to be closed. Brown got up there originally because Gerrit Smith, a millionaire abolitionist, gave that land to black slaves who had either freed or ran away, and Brown went up to teach them how to raise sheep. He had been in the business, and Brown thought that because of the adverse weather conditions up there, the sheep would be especially woolly, and their wool would be something that could be harvested, and these black people could learn how to do that. John Brown's farm is one of those great places like Thomas Jefferson's home or Mount Vernon, and they're threatening to close it. We get an update today from Louis DeCaro, who's fighting to keep it open, and he's going to give us some tips on what we can do to keep it open.
Welcome, Lou, to Law and Disorder.
Thank you. Good to be with you.
We'd first like to start talking about the importance, the symbolic importance of the John Brown Farm. Can you tell us a bit about its history and why we urge that it not be closed?
Oh, sure. Faye, I'd say there's two dimensions to that. The first dimension is what it meant to John Brown and to those he associated with. In those days, the land that he got, that he built the farm on, was land that was received from Gerrit Smith, the abolitionist, who gave land grants to a lot of people, but particularly to free blacks from New York State. And Brown wanted to become part of that community that was nicknamed Timbuktu in North Elba, near present-day Lake Placid. And Brown lived up there first in a rented farm, and then when he returned in 1854, he had his son-in-law, Henry Thompson, build that farmhouse that is there. And he moved in with his family, although he didn't really live for a long time there because he was, you know, out in his activism. But he loved the place. He loved the mountain life. He wanted to assist this burgeoning black community, which unfortunately didn't prevail. He supported, in those days, he supported the idea of black self-determination. He was something of a black nationalist in his own way, as well as being a forerunner of the civil rights movement, as my friend David Reynolds says. But he supported black self-determination, and he believed that context, that agrarian context, would be a good place for many blacks to start. Unfortunately, they weren't always successful with the climate, and the farming was hard. So he loved it. He felt close to God. He felt that this was a good place to be strategically. Some people have said that it's an underground railroad stop, and it really wasn't. Most of the African Americans that he dealt with were free folks who were trying to establish themselves in that area. So that's the first dimension. Then the second dimension is what it has meant to people, white, black, and any people who have kind of tapped into this whole liberation story. For years, African American churches made trips to the farm. John Brown was buried there, of course, after being hanged in Virginia in 1859. He's buried there with his sons, as well as raiders, both black men and white men. And according to Jean Libby, who has done a lot of work on the raid and black involvement, she even argues that there's possibly even one enslaved man whose body was mixed in with the bodies of the raiders who were killed.
And then there's a monument to the women who fought in the abolitionist movement. You know, let's talk about it, kind of describing it, Lou, because when you go up there, it really is a kind of a spiritual experience.
Yeah, it is. It's a mountaintop experience. You ascend the road, and of course, you know, it's probably much more rustic and even more challenging in John Brown's day, but you ascend this road, when you get to the top, You will see the farm, the farmhouse. There's the fenced-in area. There's a great boulder that John Brown loved. He used to sit on this boulder and read his Bible and pray, and I sit with the kids, his neighbor's kids, the Epps family, as well as his own daughters, and look out at the beauty of, you know, this beautiful scenic view. And you'll see that boulder, and he's buried next to the boulder. That area is fenced in. And then to your left, there is a statue, and I don't remember the name of the sculptor, but it's a beautiful statue of John Brown walking alongside a young black youth, probably a boy, a boy's age, may very well be representative of Lyman Epps, who was a young boy and a neighbor and friends of the Browns. But it's a symbol of Brown's collaborative support, his devotion to the black community, his acceptance within the community. It's not, you know, the cowering slave who's begging and asking. It's a, you know, it's a picture of John Brown, you know, being a support and being a friend. For years, people have gone up there. Back in the early days of the civil rights movement, churches have gone up there with busloads. My first time up there in 1999, I was up there, and there was a tour that came up. And there's not as many today. But Dr. Johnny Ray Youngblood from Brooklyn had brought, you know, his church up there. And, of course, activists, people on the left, as well as, you know, people, some kind of old-school Republicans who love to wed, you know, Lincoln and Brown, as much as I have difficulties with that. But there's a long legacy of people who have appreciated John Brown and have come up there to see it. And it really is. I brought Charles Kenyatta. This is just a personal anecdote. I brought Charles Kenyatta, who was part of Malcolm X's association, who was known as Charles 37X. I brought him up there as an elderly man in 1999. And I'll never forget just the impact that it made on him, the connections that people feel. And that's not unusual, but to feel such a connection to the past. It's really a kind of, and I say this, you know, in a certain sense, but a very spiritual, historical place where people really feel connected. The farmhouse is there. It was kind of restored to this unrestored state because when John Brown had his family move in there in 1855, it really wasn't quite finished. And, you know, it was just a very basic farmhouse with one floor and then this kind of rough stairway that would go up and then, you know, open dormer in the top.
It's real finished now. It's just a lovely, preserved place. And
yes.
And that's what we should talk about, Lou, because the place
yes.
is threatened.
Yes.
Because of the state budget crisis, they want to close it down. And if our listeners will get their pencils, I'm going to give you the names of who you can write to and protest this.
Lou, how serious is this threat? Is there a good chance this might be closed down?
Well, I hate to say it, but I think it is. I'd like to be optimistic. John Brown was famous, actually, for being very optimistic. And I've been talking to folks, including people who are really right on the front line up there. There's optimism, but there's still the real possibility. I have written to various politicians myself. I've been told, you know, well, we're going to keep fighting and, you know, all this concern. But, you know, the farm costs, according to Naj Wyckoff, our friend up there in Lake Placid, who developed the John Brown program in January, he said it takes $40,000 a year to run the farm, subtracting the $5,000 in revenue that it generates. The value of a historic site, the value of a site that means so much to so many people and actually has the potential of reflecting far more value to people as we become aware.
Let's get together and try to say $40,000 a year. That's what they pay to keep one horse for the mounted police in New York.
Yeah.
It's really,
so
it's really
gonna cut this. I mean,
terrible.
You know, yeah.
Get your pencils, listeners, because this is what we can do. There are two people in the Assembly and the State Senate that we're going to want to write to. Assemblywoman Teresa Sayward, S-A-Y-W-A-R-D, 940 Legislative Office Building, Albany, New York, 12248. Assemblyman member Teresa Sayward, 940 Legislative Office Building, Albany, New York, 12248. And the other woman that we want to write to is State Senator Betty Little, room 506, Legislative Office Building, Albany, New York, 12247. And I'm going to also give you their emails. Let's write this down, too. It's Sayward, S-A-Y-W-A-R-D, at assembly.state.ny.us. Senator Little is at little@senate.state.us. www.ny.us. So please, if enough of us protest this, for $40,000 a year, we can keep this place going. Yeah. You know, John Brown was the person who had a notion that, had it been successful, would have avoided the Civil War. He knew the Civil War was coming, that it was going to be a huge bloodbath. It was the bloodiest battle the United States has ever fought. And to avoid it, Brown thought that if he could capture the arsenal at Harper's Ferry in Virginia, that black slaves would come and attempt to free themselves by picking up arms from the arsenal and going out to fight, and other slaves would rise up and leave their plantations, and they could overthrow slavery that way. It didn't work, but it wasn't a crazy idea, as it's usually portrayed. It wasn't crazy at all. It just didn't work. Che Guevara's attempt in Bolivia didn't work. But Fidel Castro's, when they came back and fought Batista, that did work. The American revolutionaries who overthrew British colonialism, that did work. People have to take bold steps and take chances, and sometimes it does work. And that's what John Brown's and John Brown's farm represents for all of us. And that's why we want to save it.
Beautifully said. I agree. I agree that John Brown's farm, for people who see and understand that John Brown's farm really represents the possibilities for a society that is just. And it's interesting that it's marginalized. It's not just marginal in terms of where it's located, but it's marginalized in American in memory. People will go to the Lincoln Memorial. They will go to Thomas Jefferson's memorial and remember these people who were really not fully committed to human rights or who handled these issues expediently according to the priorities of white society. But here's a man who lived and died for a free and equal society. I believe that as we progress as a society, this is going to be a place that's going to be more treasured. One of the concerns that came up was that the possibility that local government, town government, would take over, and that seemed like a good solution at first. But then, you know, the great concern that arose was that people have had designs on the land to sell it, make it into a parking lot, or at least make sections of the plot. The entire plot that John Brown bought from Garrett Smith is preserved in this farm, and we want to keep it that way.
Lou, do you know if there are any protests on site being planned?
There was actually a media event, a press event on the 28th, on Sunday. Martha Swan, who is an activist and the founder of an education organization called John Brown Lives, spoke, and there was a press release that she read that before the press. But as far as any other protests, I'm not sure. Perhaps they're waiting to see what's going to happen.
Well, we've been speaking with Louis DeCaro, D-E, capital C-A-R-O. Lou has written two books on John Brown, Fire from the Myths of You, A Religious Life of John Brown, and John Brown, The Cost of Freedom. We urge people to get these books and to get a pencil, because I'm going to give you the names of the two people you can write or email to try to save John Brown's farm. We've got State Senator Betty Little, Room 506, Legislative Office Building, Albany, New York, 12247. Little at senate.state.ny.us. And the assemblywoman is Teresa Sayward, S-A-Y-W-A-R-D, 940 Legislative Office Building, Albany, New York, 12248. And that's Sayward at assembly.state.ny.us. So please, let's join together and make sure that they don't close down really one of the great spots in America, honoring one of the great Americans ever.
If anyone's interested, I have been trying to post latest reports and such on it.
We'll link yours to ours, Lou.
Okay.
Give it to us.
Thank you. It's a Blogspot blog. It's abolitionistjohnbrownblogspot.com. I suppose if you Google abolitionist John Brown blog, it should come up. abolitionist-john-brown.blogspot.com.
Lou DeCaro, thank you very much for your good work and writing about John Brown and helping to protect and preserve his farm, and for being on Law and Disorder.
Thanks for the privilege of being with you today. Bye-bye.
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 John Brown's body lies a-moldering in the grave. John Brown's body lies a-moldering in the grave. John Brown's body lies a-moldering in the grave, but his soul goes marching on. Glory, glory, hallelujah. Glory, glory, hallelujah. Glory, glory, hallelujah. But his soul goes marching on. The stars above in heaven are looking kindly down. The stars above in heaven are looking kindly down. The stars above in heaven are looking kindly down on the grave of old John Brown. Glory, glory, hallelujah. Glory, glory, hallelujah. Glory, glory, hallelujah. His soul goes marching on. He captured Harper's Ferry with his 19 men so true. He frightened old Virginia till she trembled through and through. They hanged him for a traitor, they themselves the traitor crew. His soul goes marching on. Glory, glory, hallelujah. Glory, glory, hallelujah. Glory, glory, hallelujah. His soul goes marching on. Well, he's gone to be a soldier in the army of the Lord. He's gone to be a soldier in the army of the Lord. He's gone to be a soldier in the army of the Lord. But his soul goes marching on. Glory, glory, hallelujah. Glory, glory, hallelujah. Glory, glory, hallelujah. His soul goes marching on. Mine eyes had seen the glory of the coming of the Lord. He is trampling out the vintage where the grapes of wrath is stored. He loosed the fateful lightning of his terrible swift sword. His truth is marching on. Glory, glory, hallelujah. Glory, glory, hallelujah. Glory, glory, hallelujah.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org. That's lawanddisorder.org. Thank you.